Welcome to the Nutrition Science Podcast, where we help you cut through the noise and make informed, science-based decisions about nutrition and your health. Welcome back to another episode of the Nutrition Science Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian Chavez, and in this episode, we are going to be talking about weight loss medications. And this is a topic that I have gotten lots of questions about recently. And this is something that I haven't discussed much because I am not an expert in this topic. I focus on nutrition. And those of you who listen to the show know that I value expertise. So I brought my friend onto the show today, Dr. Nisha Patel, who is an internal medicine and obesity medicine physician. She is the director of the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and weight management program at California Pacific Medical Center. And she's someone who I connected with a few years back who really emphasizes the importance of nutrition and lifestyle in overall health. So we have very closely aligning philosophies here, but she's someone who regularly prescribes these medications to her patients. She's monitoring them, she's following up with them, and she's reading the research on these medications as well. So I brought her onto the show today to share her knowledge and experience with using these medications, to tell us what they do, how they work. We're also going to talk about some of the medications that many of you may not even be aware of. So everyone knows about the Wegovy and the Ozempic and the Mounjaro and the new GLP-1 agonists is what they're called, these long-acting GLP-1 agonists. Many people have heard of those because those have become more popular recently, but there's other medications that are also used for weight management that we're going to discuss. And she's going to talk about how they all work. We're also going to go into detail about these GLP-1 agonists, how they work, side effects, what to look out for, what to consider before getting on these medications, what you should be asking your doctor, what your doctor should be asking you, and a whole lot more. So this is going to be a very informative episode for anyone who's considering going on these medications or anyone who's currently on these medications to understand them a little bit better so that you can make more informed decisions about your health and about what's best for you. Another thing that I wanted to mention, so Dr. Patel and I, we've known each other for a couple of years now. We've met in person several times. We connected through social media, but she's really just an overall good person. And one of the things that I wanted to really point out to you all is the people that I'm bringing on the podcast, I get asked 25 times per week of people asking to be on the show. And sometimes it's pretty popular people. There's a lot of people asking to be featured on the show because it gives recognition. It gives exposure to the audience, to those of you who are listening. I am very, very diligent about vetting the people who I bring onto the show. So I've been bringing on a few more guests recently, and I just wanted to really clarify that the people that I'm bringing on, you can trust these people. The information that they're sharing is great, but beyond the knowledge, everyone that I'm bringing on the show, I usually know pretty well. I've known them for quite a bit of time before I've asked them to come onto the show because I don't want to expose you all to people who you're going to start to follow, you're going to take advice from, they're going to share misleading information, they're going to try to use scammy sales tactics on you or any of that. Just wanted to emphasize that anyone I'm bringing on the show is really well vetted, and I really recommend you guys follow them. And my goal with bringing people on the show is, yes, to expose you all to new information, but to expose you to people who have expertise in various topics that I don't necessarily have expertise in, so that you can follow them and learn from them as well. And you can create a toolbox, if you will, of individuals who can provide you with evidence-based information in the various areas of nutrition and health that are important to you. So I'm very particular about who I choose to bring on. And as I mentioned, I know a lot of these guests, and I have known them for quite some time, like Casey, who I brought on to talk about behavior change, Alyssa, who I brought on to talk about exercise, Pat, who I brought on to talk about sports nutrition, Crystal, who I brought on to talk about cancer nutrition, Nicole, who I brought on to talk about nutrition and mental health. I've known all these people for quite some time before I asked them to come onto the show because I want to make sure that the people who I'm exposing you all to are trustworthy, and I don't just want to bring a bunch of people on the show because they're popular and it's going to help me get more listeners because I'm featuring popular people, because that's how a lot of these podcasts work. So I got some great feedback about the sports nutrition episode with Patrick over on YouTube. So I am publishing the podcast over on YouTube now. If you want to go leave a comment and you want to go subscribe to the YouTube channel and be able to access them through YouTube, you can do so there. I'm also going to be publishing shorts of the podcast there, so you'll get some small snippets of information that way as well. So if you just type in Dr. Adrian Chavez on YouTube, you will find the YouTube channel, and you can subscribe and find the video version of the podcast as well. One other quick announcement. I've also created a new website for the podcast. So if you go to thenutritionscience.com, you will find all of the episodes there. There's a search bar where you can search all of the episodes, and all of the information related to the podcast is there. So from now on, if you are looking for something in particular related to the podcast, links, show notes, products that I recommend, just go to thenutritionscience.com and you can find it all there. There's a search bar that makes it really easy to find any topics or episodes that you want to refer back to. So go check out that website for all things related to the podcast. If you want to share the podcast with anyone, that's thenutritionsciencepodcast.com. I think I said it wrong a second ago. I think I just said thenutritionscience.com. It's thenutritionsciencepodcast.com. So thenutritionsciencepodcast.com, that is going to be the best place to find anything related to the podcast from here forward. All right, so let's go ahead and get into the episode. It's a long one, but it's very informative and insightful, and I think you're going to really enjoy it.
All right, welcome to the show, Dr. Patel. I'm really excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk to you about this topic. I know it's been on everyone's mind and a topic of lots of conversation and on social media and just kind of like all over wherever you look. Yeah,
definitely. These medications have definitely created much of a stir recently, and they're you know, for good reason. We'll talk about, you know, what that is, and we'll go into detail. But first, I want to go into a little bit about what got you into this field, what got you into the field of medicine. And then also, I want to also touch on why you got interested in nutrition. Because for those of you who don't know, for those of you who are just listening, Dr. Patel and I got connected through Instagram, and she is also just very interested in nutrition. That's why we got connected, is she was posting about nutrition and just really interested in the topic, asking me questions about some of the things that I was posting about. And I love to see, you know, MDs and you know, quote unquote, conventional healthcare settings who are really, you know, putting that emphasis on nutrition and lifestyle. So can you give us a little bit of background as to what got you into the field of medicine and then nutrition as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'm a physician, and I guess it's really cliche to say this, but I actually did want to become a physician since I was younger, and not because my parents told me to or whatnot. My grandfather, he had founded this clinic or hospital in a village in India and was like really able to help a lot of individuals. And that was really inspiring to me. And when I started my journey in medicine, especially through training, I actually thought I wanted to be an oncologist. And if you're not familiar with that term, that's a cancer doctor, which is completely different from what I'm doing right now and opposite of what I'm doing right now. But, you know, as I went through training, I'm South Asian. I'm of Indian ancestry. And when I was completing my residency towards the end, I actually was diagnosed with prediabetes. I was 30 years old. And I remember just thinking, like, how could I be 30 and have prediabetes and also high cholesterol? And if truth be told, if I, you know, had to look back and look at my entire training, there was never this emphasis on following a healthy lifestyle or, you know, what does healthy nutrition or what does a healthful dietary pattern even look like? I remember being in training and thinking to myself, when one of my patients who just had a heart attack was being discharged from the hospital, and his one question to me was, hey, doc, I just had a heart attack. So like, what kind of diet should I follow? And I literally looked at him. I didn't really even know what to say. I said that I will consult the dietitian, but there was at least some comfort I could have given him had I had the training or had some background knowledge. But, you know, it just wasn't emphasized in our training. You know, we learned about diagnosing diseases and treating diseases, all the medications, like why diseases developed. But when we talked about prevention, it was just, was hardly a focus of any of our lectures. And, you know, as time went on, I really discovered the field of obesity medicine. And again, I was never taught that obesity is a chronic disease. And all of my training, it was always kind of, you know, just glossed over as like a risk factor for certain medical conditions. But, you know, when I dug in and actually attended some conferences and really started to understand like why this was happening, I just became just so incredibly fascinated. I have a neuroscience background. I have a formal degree in neuroscience. And I realized that there was just such a big component of neuroscience in our brain as far as, you know, energy regulation and body weight regulation. And so I you know, decided to pursue board certification and I currently direct an obesity medicine program at a major medical center here in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And it's really just transformed my career and my life. And you know, it's been great connecting with Dr. Chavez as well. You know, he's obviously a wonderful expert in nutrition. And it's just, it goes to show you that, you know, we really need to bring that back into the conversation of modern medicine. And not because doctors need to be the end-all, be-all, know-all. We have nutrition professionals out there that can help us, and we really need to integrate this care. And I'm on the mission to really, you know, do that, even in my own practice, and especially for diseases like cardiometabolic diseases is a term maybe you're not familiar with, but that's the intersection of, you know, conditions like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which that name is now changed to something else. But there's this intersection between all of these disease processes, and the foundation of care is a healthy lifestyle, especially healthful nutrition. But that part of the conversation, unfortunately, is still lacking in our system, but it is starting to change slowly. So that is truly my passion and like why I do what I do.
Yeah. I love to hear it. And that's, I came from the other side, and that's what got me into this space is exactly what you said is, in my opinion, nutrition is the most underutilized form of medicine. Like, it is
absolutely
a form of medicine that is not utilized properly. There is not the right specialists. There's not the right support networks. There's not the right referral systems. And that is really what needs to be done in healthcare. Like, that's the step in healthcare that is going to really help to improve care overall. If we can actually get there, because obviously the incentives are not there in terms of people being, you know, reimbursement, actually being able to reimburse nutrition, lifestyle services, those type of things. But nutrition, obviously exercise as well, which is, in my opinion, just easier. That's where I think we need more support. We need more, you know, specialists in terms of, you know, people being able to really provide that care when it comes to nutrition. And with exercise, you can kind of, and you know, it's not that simple, of course, but with exercise, it's like, just move more. Just exercise more.
Yeah.
And if you do
bit
that,
less, move more. Yeah.
Most of the benefits of exercise are going to come from the engaging in the movement, no matter what it is, as opposed to with nutrition, you know, you really need the right guidance, because it's really easy to get pulled in the wrong directions. And you can do that with exercise. You know, people can give you exercise programs that aren't as good as others, but you're still going to get benefit from moving when it comes to exercise.
Yeah.
Whereas nutrition, if someone puts you on a carnivore diet, for example, you know, you go online, you have high cholesterol, you're like, what do I do? And then you get into this low carb group that says, you know, the best thing to improve your cholesterol levels is to cut out all of your plant foods and eat carnivore. And that can be a problem. Like, that can kill
absolutely
you. Take years off your life. And I know you can speak to that as a specialist in this field and a lipidologist, and you know all about the way that carnivore diet impacts cholesterol levels and all of that. And that's where I think, you know, when it comes to the healthcare system, we really need more support around nutrition. And that really is the key in the future, is really helping to build those systems in place so that doctors, physicians don't have to be expected to be that person. Because as we were just talking about before we got on this podcast, it is impossible to keep up with the research on, you know, on nutrition and on medications. And that's why, you know, I get asked about this topic often. I've been asked to speak on this topic, to make podcasts, to answer stories on this topic, and I don't. And the reason I don't is because I am not an expert in medications. And that's why I wanted to bring Dr. Patel on today, is because she actually is, and she can speak more to that than I can.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I dream of a day that, you know, we integrate all of this wonderful care that's missing into the health system. And yeah, I mean, doctors frankly don't have time to counsel appropriately on nutrition, nor I think is it, you know, really something that we have to do, because again, we have specialists, we have people that have spent years learning. But yeah, like, and I will say one of the more common questions I also get on social media is regarding medications for weight management, to treat obesity. And it's, you know, there's a lot of great information out there and there's a lot of not so great information. So looking forward to our discussion and hopefully clarifying some of those misconceptions and helping people understand and make an informed decision.
Definitely, definitely. And I love that you ended it with that piece, is that's, and everyone who listens to this podcast knows that that's the way that I approach every topic, is really, we're not trying to encourage you or you know, kind of move you in one direction or the other, just to give you the right information so that you can make an informed decision that makes the most sense for you. Because with everything, with medications, with nutrition, there's a lot of things to consider. And I always get questions like, what do you think about these medications? And there's so much to consider that even if I, you know, did have the expertise to answer that question, it just requires a more nuanced discussion, which is what we're going to have today. So let's go ahead and get into it. And let's start off with talking about what these medications are. So like, what are the names? I know everyone's heard of like Wegovy. And so let's talk about what the brand names are, you know, what these medications do. Let's start there and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, and before I start, I'm going to use brand names of medications, but I have no financial conflicts or disclosures with any pharmaceutical companies out there. I don't work for anyone or consult for anyone. It's just, I've purposely done that. You know, I want to be as kind of clear and unbiased as possible. But, you know, when you think about the medications for weight management or to treat the chronic disease of obesity, the way to think about it is that it's a tool in our toolbox, right? These medications are not a quick fix. They're not the end all be all. They're supposed to be used in conjunction with creating that health promoting lifestyle, working on our nutrition, working on our fitness, stress management, and sleep. These are all things that I talk to my patients about at every visit. And we use the medications as a tool to really help them with those efforts. And the other thing I always, always emphasize with everyone, even before I start medications, you know, these are meant to be long-term medications. Just like if you come off of your blood pressure medications abruptly, your blood pressure can go up. And this is the same phenomenon that we see in the majority of patients, that if they abruptly stop these medications, they can have a rebound as far as weight regain. Now, you know, some may think that these medications are all brand new. We've only had medications for a few years, given how much popularity there's been around, you know, Zepbound or Wegovy. These are both brand names that we, once a week injectable medications. But in reality, we've been treating the chronic disease of obesity for many, many years. And we've actually had medications prior to the ones that you've heard about in the media that are, you know, we actually, like Wegovy is not the first GLP-1 receptor agonist that was approved for weight management. It was actually Saxenda, and that was almost a decade ago. But we don't really talk about Saxenda, and you don't really kind of hear about it because you do have these other more efficacious medications that we're hearing about. We also have pill medications that we've been using that people take daily. So some people may not realize that, you know, there's actually multiple options for treatment, but, you know, it's not just once a week injectable medications. Now that's what you're hearing all the hype about. So, you know, when you talk about some of the I'm talking about the FDA approved medications for weight management, we actually also use certain medications off label because not everybody has insurance coverage. And, you know, we really have to try to help our patients with the resources that are available to them. And so, but the FDA approved medications, when it comes to like the pill medications, actually include medications like orlistat, Qsymia, which is a combination pill of two medications called phentermine and topiramate. There's Contrave, which is Wellbutrin and naltrexone. Phentermine actually was one of the first approved medications for weight management. It's over like 50 years, you know, ago that we approved it for weight management. And we still actually use that medication to this day. There's also Saxenda, which is the one that I mentioned earlier. That's a daily GLP-1 receptor agonist medication. So that's opposed to what you see now in the media with Wegovy and Zepbound, which are Wegovy was approved in 2021. Zepbound got approved in 2023. So that one's the newest one that we've added to our armamentarium. And if you are confused sometimes when we use these terms interchangeably, but I need to make sure that people understand that Wegovy and Ozempic are the same medication. I know that there was a lot of like, you know, Ozempic is a diabetes drug, and why are we using a diabetes drug for weight management? But the reality is that they're the same medication. They're just two different brand names. So Ozempic got approved for type 2 diabetes in 2017, and then Wegovy got approved in 2021 for the treatment of obesity. And the same thing with Mounjaro and Zepbound. So same exact medication, same exact dosing frequency. The Mounjaro was approved for type 2 diabetes, and Zepbound was approved for weight management. And so, yeah, it's a little confusing. Yeah, go ahead.
Clarify, because you've gone over a lot.
So, yeah, well, we've gone over a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's back up a little bit. So the weight loss medications, So the orlistat, that one works by basically blocking absorption of fat in our
intestine,
causing us to kind of poop out some of the calories that we causes like loose stool, and can slightly reduce our calorie, you know.
That one we don't, I'll be honest, don't use as much. So I don't even actually like talk to patients about it. But it is one that people should be aware of that is technically approved.
And then the others, all of the others are more, are they stimulants?
Good question. So we don't know exactly. So so the medications for weight management primarily, besides orlistat, actually work in the brain. And we don't know exactly how, like for instance, in Q-simia, the phentermine, you know, is an appetite suppressant, but it also works on different areas. Like it works on different areas in the brain. The hypothalamus, if you're not familiar, it's just a structure in our brain that really has some areas that are responsible for energy balance and regulation of body weight. And what we're really talking about when we say weight, I'm specifically referring to what's called adiposity. Adiposity is the medical term for body fat. And so that's what we're really talking about here. So they primarily work in the brain. We don't know exactly how they work, but there are, you know, places in the brain that they work to help with appetite, you know, decrease hunger. Contrave specifically, that's the naltrexone bupropion combination, again, also works in the brain, can really help individuals if they're having certain kind of strong cravings. But we also see improvement in cravings when you use medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. So we tend to use those if those are available. Same thing for, you know, Wegovy, Saxenda, and Zepbound works in the brain. They do have what's called peripheral actions or actions elsewhere in the body. So if you can imagine, you know, some of these medications also improve diabetes, right? Because they improve blood sugar control and help the insulin or the pancreas be a little bit more efficient in insulin secretion. And so there's other actions. The other thing to realize about medications like Wegovy and Zepbound is that they're being studied for other kind of disease processes that are to look at improvements in certain outcomes that are independent of weight. So, you know, we see recently with Wegovy, there's been, you know, a reduction in heart disease risk in patients that have obesity and heart disease. There's been studies that have looked at the fatty liver disease that I was referring to earlier. In patients with diabetes and chronic kidney disease, the Ozempic or semaglutide, which is, again, the generic for Ozempic and Wegovy, has been shown to reduce progression to dialysis. So, I mean, these are not just, I really want to clarify, these are not just like weight management medications. Like we are seeing other host of like effects and outcomes that are improving. But, you know, we commonly see that patients with obesity have some of these other conditions. And so there's a lot of potential benefit to be had in the appropriate patients. So that was a lot to cover in that, you know, in that one little segment. So, but that's kind of a big overview of what the medications are.
So you mentioned GLP-1 agonist. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Yeah. So GLP-1 is a hormone that our body makes in response to eating. So whenever we ingest food, our body makes GLP-1. That's a hormone that's made in our small intestine.
For glucagon-like
peptide? Glucagon-like peptide 1. And it exerts some effects. It helps us with fullness, helps with blood sugar management. But the problem is in our own body, GLP-1 gets degraded pretty quickly, meaning it gets cleared away very quickly within a matter of minutes. And so it doesn't really have a long time to interact in our brain. Remember, I told you the brain is a really important regulator of energy balance and our adiposity, or I'm going to just kind of surrogate say body weight. And so it really doesn't have a lot of time to interact in our brain because it gets cleared away really fast. So pharmaceutical companies like Novo Nordisk have made long-acting GLP-1 agonists. So they work on the same receptors as our own GLP-1, but for way longer. The half-life of the GLP-1 agonist medication, like with Wegovy, for instance, is actually a week, which is so much longer than the minutes that we have for our native or our own intrinsic GLP-1. So quickly, way longer.
Half-life means how long it takes for our body to break down that medication from what you took in to half of that amount of dose. So normally, when our body makes GLP-1, within a few minutes, our body will break down 50% of that. It'll continue to break it down. It'll be gone in a few minutes. With these medications, the half-life is a week. So this GLP-1 stays in our system for a lot longer than the GLP-1 that we produce in our body. So how does our body produce this peptide? Like, when, what causes our body to produce GLP-1, and what role does it play in hunger, satiety, weight management? Like, what is it doing?
Yeah. So our body produces our own GLP-1 in response to eating. So when we eat something, a mixed meal, what happens is that, you know, we eat and then nutrients get absorbed and our blood sugar rises. And GLP-1 causes when it comes to blood sugar management, a dose dependent insulin secretion. So insulin, again, is a really important hormone in our body. It actually helps us bring our blood sugar down. And so what the GLP-1 does is it makes sure that our insulin response is actually inappropriate to what the rise in blood sugar is. And so, you know, that's one mechanism of action. Like I said, it's not really lasting long enough. I mean, yes, it does us some signaling to the brain, but it's really not, you know, it's not lasting long enough to maybe create some prolonged satiety or prolonged fullness and decrease in hunger. It's also important to understand, like what I alluded to earlier, is that there's actually GLP-1 receptors all over our body. So there's receptors in the heart, kidney, liver, blood vessels. I mean, it's really not just like in one specific area, not just our gut or our brain. And so whenever you take GLP-1 receptor agonist, that effect of what our GLP-1 does in our body is actually lasting a lot longer. And so you do have that, like the hypothalamus and other areas of the brain have GLP-1 receptors. And so what these medications do, they in general can help with hunger, appetite control, satiety, and cravings. And I will tell you that there are biological variations as far as like what people are experiencing. You know, some of my patients have really strong cravings and they're, you know, constantly kind of thinking about food or thinking about specific foods and kind of going out of their way to seek them. Some of my patients will tell me, I just can never feel full. I come from a family of individuals where we just, you know, we know that we should not eat this X amount of food, because we've already had this amount of food already. Maybe it's their third serving. They know that they don't really like need it, but they do because they don't feel full. And so these medications, I mean, I've seen like people's lives transformed because it really helps them control that, you know, the cravings. It helps them, you know, feel fuller so they don't have to eat as much. It helps their hunger decrease, because the one thing people may have noticed, anyone that's been through a weight loss effort, you know, as you lose weight, your body does start making it harder to lose additional weight. And unfortunately, you know, you may develop a weight plateau and you actually might start feeling hungrier. And it's really hard to fight those biological drives. And so I always tell patients that these medications are leveling the playing field for you. It's really truly fascinating, you know, to see like people who are constantly, their lives revolve around food, and then they just come in and they're like, I don't have to think about food the way I did before. I don't have to consume, or I have to spend all of this energy, you know, thinking about food, and I can focus on, you know, creating healthier habits. And it's just like something, just like the light bulb like switches in their brain.
Yeah.
And it's just too. Very interesting.
Like, the food noise goes away.
Yeah, the food noise, that's the term.
Yeah, I wanna back up, and that mm-hmm. I have a couple things that I want to talk about though. So
yeah.
I don't want to forget it. So the GLP-1, when you say that it can have an effect on the brain, so when we're creating it, it doesn't necessarily have that effect because it's broken down quickly, but when we take it as a medication, we found that it does have an effect. And what's going on there? Is it changing like transmitters? Do we know what's going on there? Like what actually is the compound doing in the brain?
Yeah, it's binding to different receptors in the brain and changing like neurosignaling. So I think there's, you know, a lot to still be learned about exactly what's happening, but you know, it's prolonging the effects of what should be happening if your own native GLP-1 was doing that. And so it's working on everyone's like individual biology. So if, you know, there are, you know, if patients are having trouble with satiety because that's just their own biology, the kind of their genetic predisposition, it will, you know, work on the GLP-1 receptor to improve satiety. So, you know, it's not like there's different areas, like I said, in the brain that the GLP-1 receptors act on, but it kind of that overall general theme of like, it, you know, helps with hunger, satiety, appetite, and cravings, depending on what the individual is experiencing. Because I actually spend a lot of time when I first meet a patient and kind of understanding like, well, what are you feeling? Like, Are you having trouble with fullness? Are you feeling hungry all the time? Are you having cravings? Are you, you know, like, what are you eating? And like, why are you eating? Are you eating because you're hungry? Are you eating out of boredom? Are you eating because of drives? So it really helps with some of those biological drives. You know, of course, there's other reasons that we eat. If we eat out of boredom or if we eat because we're stressed, like there's, you know, things that we have to work on there, but it's really helping those biological drives to eat or eat more than intended. And everyone's kind of different in like what they're experiencing. Like it's just very, very, very interesting.
So,
kind of talking to patients.
That's the next point that I wanted to touch on is you mentioned if you come from a family of people who all have struggle with, you know, kind of shutting off that switch and stopping eating. A lot of people will hear this and hear some of the stuff that you're saying, and they'll immediately assume, well, you know, that's just bad habits. That's just bad programming. I was one of those people, honestly, like probably 15 years ago, you know, even less than that, I definitely felt that way. And then I started consulting for a genetics company. And I did some consulting work in the genetics of obesity, and I read some of those papers, and it blew my mind. I was just like, wow, there is a neurobiological component of that's impacting people's drive to eat, desire to eat, ability to say no, ability to turn off when they start eating, you know, all of these different things. And I always thought it was willpower, you know, and we hear this all the time. We hear this, you know, it's willpower, it's willpower. And I know that there's probably people listening to this who, as they're hearing you say this, they're thinking, that's just bad family habits. That's just, you know, these people have just developed bad habits. And the reality is that we truly experience these feelings and these drives differently. And we have to be able to realize that, like, when you see someone and you're like, oh, they just don't have the willpower, their brain probably works differently than yours to the point where they experience. And one of the things that fascinated me was a lot of the genes that seem to be associated with obesity were the genes that were associated with, like,
in the brain
from food.
Yeah.
The pleasure that's derived from food. And it's like the people who experience more pleasure from food tend to have a higher body weight. And that makes complete sense. Like, and as I'm reading about this, I'm like, oh, I love food too. And that's, like, that's one of the reasons that I got into this field too, is because I just really enjoy eating. And I'm like, I need to be able to do this in a way that, you know, isn't harmful to my health, is definitely one of the draws to nutrition for me. And so can you speak about that a little bit more in terms of like the individual differences and what's really going on there, and why, you know, for some people, you know, obesity isn't a choice. Like, you know, we hear this, obesity is a choice. You know, people have heard this, people have probably said this before. Can you speak more to why that isn't necessarily the case?
Yeah. And some of those, you know, genetic variations that we see in certain genes, like, they impact hunger and satiety. Like, they're actually loci from the brain, and it's very, like, just very interesting. I mean, you know, the way I kind of explain it, or the theory behind it, is that when, like, thousands of years ago, when our ancestors were, you know, not in the same environment that we were in, obviously we're in an environment that's very challenging. You know, Dr. Chavez and I were talking about how it's like the healthier choice is not the easy choice in our current food environment. But, you know, many, 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 many years ago, it was thought that when our ancestors were either spending all this energy, you know, getting food, whether it be, you know, I'm using the word foraging, like, very simplistic, but foraging and searching for food, any, like, weight loss that they developed was, like, a threat to their survival, right? Because if they, like, had weight loss or malnutrition, I should say, and then they couldn't, you know, reproduce or propagate the species, they were basically screwed. And so their brain developed, I should say, mechanisms to, quote unquote, and the word combat I'm going to use in quotations because, or defend against weight loss, because this is hotly debated. But yeah, basically to make it so if they started losing weight, that there would be mechanisms to combat that. And so we've unfortunately brought some of those drives, some of those predispositions, I should say, into this, like, very modern, totally the opposite of what, you know, was happening, like, even 100 years ago, food environment. So you're taking a genetically and biologically predisposed individual and putting them into this food environment and you're saying, okay, go thrive, right? It's like putting a canary in the coal mine and saying, go live now. That's like super hard, right? When you have something that you're constantly having to fight against, thinking it's all your fault. But in reality, like there's true biology that's happening. And it's really tough because even I talk about kind of my experiences, you know, again, pre-diabetes, South Asian, strong cravings for sugar runs in my family. I'm pretty sure that, you know, when my mom was pregnant with me, I somehow got rewired to have these biological urges. And that happens, you know, we know that our environment, you know, when, especially when our moms or individuals are pregnant, there's epigenetic remodeling of what's happening to the baby. And sorry, I'm using really scientific terms, but that's the environmental influence on expression of genes. And then, you know, you go out, you're born and you go out to this environment, you develop and you have exposures from, you know, continued exposures from the environment. Genes are turning on and off. And it's just like, you know, this is, again, real biology that's happening. And it's truly, truly, truly fascinating. If I had to argue, I mean, there's a lot of arguments out there of like, we need to work on preventing obesity. And I agree with you. And that starts really early. In fact, that, you know, helping individuals that are thinking about having children get healthy, not only for their kids, for themselves, I think that's where it really starts. And of course, you know, intervening and helping children learn these habits early and really kind of understand like the role that food plays in health in a really healthy manner, you know, not in an antagonistic or negative way that ruins them for the rest of their life. But it's just really interesting because I think that there's a lot of doctors out there that think that obesity is caused by a lack of willpower. And that's, to be honest with you, like a lot of that kind of the little tidbits of like obesity that I did learn about in training, it was actually like that messaging was coming across like people just need healthier habits. And if they had healthier habits, they wouldn't have obesity.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And truly, even in nutrition training, a lot of that, we were getting a lot of that early on. Fortunately, I had a really good professor. His name was Dr. Glenn Gaser. He wrote a book called, I think it's called The Obesity Myth. But he was great about giving us an alternative perspective. At that point, genes weren't like the genetics of all of this wasn't really well mapped out. Probably dating myself a little bit, but these things weren't well mapped out at that point. But one of the things, and I was thinking about this as you were talking about it, that fascinated me that he kind of exposed us to was some of the studies on, you know, during like, I think it was like the Irish potato famine, where when kids who were basically in their mother's womb during that time who were exposed to very like, you know,
poor nutrition, yeah,
ended up having very high rates of obesity after that. And the theory was that because of the lack of food during, you know, during gestation, that they, once they were kids, that they just had a really strong drive to find calories, because that, like you mentioned, that epigenetic remodeling, and that epigenetic remodeling means that, you know, you have your genes and then your genes can kind of change the way that they express themselves based on the things that you expose yourselves, or we get exposed to, especially early in life. In some of these early life events can really change the way that our genes express themselves, to the point where you can have a genetic predisposition and then have other factors that make it even worse, like something that happens during, you know, pregnancy, and then something that happens during childhood. You know, you get exposed to the wrong environments and gain a bunch of weight during childhood, and change, you know, your response to hunger and satiety due to, you know, various habits early in, or like exposures early in childhood, and all of these things can add up to lead someone to make it almost impossible for them to be able to really like regulate their weight. And
it's hard.
It's hard sometimes for the average person to understand this, but as someone, and for me, a lot of it is just, it's just taken a lot of training, and then also the experience of working with so many people at this point. You know, I've worked with over a thousand people in various group programs and things, and one-to-one, and I've seen multiple clients who have truly struggled with like really low calorie intakes and lots of movement, and they just cannot, their metabolism works a little bit differently, their drive to eat works a little bit differently, and they're constantly struggling. And when you see those circumstances, and you know, that's where these weight loss medications can really fill a gap, as you said, as to be used as a tool in the toolbox. So let's talk a little bit more about, who can benefit from the mm-hmm. use of them, and then I want to get into side effects a little bit more before we close things out. So in terms of like who's a candidate, when does it make sense? When are you thinking about, you know, prescribing these medications?
Yeah, so the FDA has criteria that they use that insurance companies basically abide by. And so I know, again, controversy, I don't know how people feel about this, but I'm just going to say that the criteria are what the criteria are, and they are BMI based. That is what it is. And this is, again, because of insurance coverage and what that boils down to. So any individual with a BMI of 30 kilograms per meter squared or greater, or an individual that has a BMI of 27 kilograms per meter squared, plus what's called an obesity-related comorbidity. So that could be, you know, diabetes or liver disease or, you know, another condition. Like, it is a candidate for treatment. Now, that's just kind of a preliminary, you know, criteria. Like, as a doctor, I have to go through a patient's medical history and really understand, like, okay, what are their medical conditions? What are what's called the contraindications? These are situations where we not use the medication because the risks are greater than the potential benefits. And then, you know, really having that risk versus benefits discussion, again, wanting everyone to understand that these are really meant to be long-term medications, because, you know, they're not something we just start for 3 months and just send you on your way after that and while stopping it. So again, really important to understand that. You know, there's different side effect profiles for depending on which medication you're using. You know, some of the oral medications, if you have, like, for instance, like contrary, like if you have uncontrolled high blood pressure, you really don't want to use that. Same thing with Qsymia. If you have a history of cardiac disease or heart disease, or if you're having some sort of arrhythmia, which is an abnormal heart rhythm, we really don't want to use the medications in that situation. Specifically, Qsymia, also if you have kidney stones or glaucoma, like there's a lot of different contraindications to think about, which is why it's so important that you get this medication, get the medications from somebody who has comfort in prescribing them and really going through those risk versus benefit discussions. Because right now you can see all of the interesting things that happen on the web, which we won't get into on this podcast, but lots of prescribing that's not the most kosher, I should say. You know, so I'll kind of focus on some of the more efficacious medications, or the ones you hear about in the news. So when we kind of switch to the once a week injectables, we're talking about Wegovy again and Zepbound. You know, GI side effects are the most common. And, you know, again, you want to understand somebody's history. Like, do they already have GI symptoms from another medical condition? How could this medication impact those GI symptoms that they're already having? You know, are they having nausea from something else? And nausea and constipation, I will say, are like the most common side effects in my patient population. Knock on wood, I haven't seen pancreatitis, which is another one that, you know, kind of comes up in the conversation. Pancreatitis is inflammation of the pancreas. That's a medical emergency. So that's not something subtle, you know, but I have not seen that. And there's been some reanalysis of some data that really we're not seeing that strong signal or risk of pancreatitis, but GI side effects are common. You know, you do want to make sure that patients are counseled appropriately. You do want to make sure that patients are not just started on the medication and then they're like seen 6 months later and hope for the best. You know, I do follow my patients pretty closely, especially when we're starting medications and going up on the dose gradually as they tolerate it. And I like to keep my patients on the lowest dose possible that they're responding to. Kind of going back to the biology piece of it, though, I think something that's really also very interesting is there can be significant inter-individual variability in the response to medication. So you could have like two people that are doing the same exact thing and they're taking the medication, but one might actually have a more robust response than the other individual. And again, there's some genetic or biological factor there. I wish there was like a prediction model that I could use to say like, you're going to respond, like based on these factors, you'll respond with this degree of weight loss, but I don't have that. So significant inter-individual variability, very interesting. I think that, you know, patients need to understand that this is, again, the lifestyle factors matter. Because I, you know, I have patients that don't really, there's a subset of patients that don't have robust weight loss with the medications. Maybe it's something related to their biology. Maybe there's something lifestyle-wise that we need to work on. You know, we try to make sure that everything is teed up here, but they may not respond because of something in their biology that's preventing them, despite, you know, trying to follow a health-promoting dietary pattern that reduces the number of calories we're eating. They're managing their stress. Maybe they're having some sleep disruption that's making them hungrier. So you got to think of all these factors when patients aren't responding. But again, these are not magic medications where, you know, everyone gets started and everyone's going to have this like amazing response. The majority of patients will have weight loss, right? It's just that we want to make sure it's done in a healthy way We don't want people to lose, you know, excess lean muscle. Of course, you've seen a lot of that kind of maybe out in the news or social media. You know, when you lose weight, it's not just fat loss, you're also losing lean body mass. And, you know, I definitely emphasize, you know, adequate lean protein intake and resistance training and really trying to help patients find whatever works for them, because we do want healthy weight loss. We don't want you to get frail as you lose weight, especially if you're older and have more medical conditions. So, you know, lots of things to be thought about and discussed. And it really, if somebody is just kind of giving you a medication without talking to you about side effects or talking to you about even benefits or what to expect or who to contact if you're having problems, like that's a huge red flag for me. Huge red flag. And I know that's happening.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That is definitely happening. There's a lot of overprescribing from what I've seen, and not, as you mentioned, not closely monitoring and not properly describing side effects. So can we talk about those a little bit more?
Sure.
I'm not really familiar with them. I only know what I know from speaking to people on them. And so you mentioned GI side effects. What are those and like what's going on there?
Yeah. So there's nausea that can be experienced, especially tends to happen more in my patient population with like medications like Wegovy versus the Zepbound. You know, there's actually GLP-1 receptors in an area called the area postrema, which is a part of our brain that I'm not going to call it the vomiting center, but that's like kind of the colloquial term for it. And so, you know, the GLP-1 receptors, again, they're all over, right? So they're not just working on specific ones, they're working all over the place. And so it can stimulate those neurons. And so some patients can have, you know, some pretty profound nausea, which is very interesting, but it's again, very inter-individual variability. You know, there's patients that don't have any.
I want to ask more about that. Because I personally, I was talking to someone who was on a medication. I forget which one, but he said that he has terrible nausea, but that's what's helping him lose weight is because he can't eat. Because I was out eating at a restaurant, and you know, they're just, him and his wife were both taking the medications, and they just shared one meal and kind of had like, you know, a little bit of chicken wings and french fries, and they only ate like a really tiny amount. And I'm like, the amount of nutrient deficiencies that are going to occur if you guys continue to eat this way. I didn't go into detail there. I was just like, oh, cool. But I'm concerned about that piece of it. And so the nausea piece, is it brain, or is it also like a GI issue?
It can be a GI issue because it can slow gastric emptying. And so, yeah. So
that's what I thought. I wasn't sure though.
There's peripheral effects as well. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This person said that if he ate too much, he would throw up. And he said that it happened to him multiple times. And I was just like, this doesn't sound very appealing as he's describing this. Because he said that he was telling us about a time where he ate two slices of pizza and he threw up after the second slice, like at the table, because he just like was so full immediately.
So that's the other thing. We do counsel patients that if they eat a meal that has, you know, higher fat content meals, because they could have kind of worsening nausea and vomiting. I think the thought is that it decreases, like somehow there's like a decrease in like the ability for like lipase to ingest the fat. I don't know. It's very interesting because I looked this up and I was like, why is this happening? And sure, it could be, you know, delayed gastric emptying because the fat of your meal moves slower. But yeah, it is. So we do counsel patients on that. If they're going to have like a cheeseburger for their birthday or something, like you're probably not going to feel very good on it. But I want people to understand that like the way individuals lose weight is not because we don't want them to be so nauseous that they stop eating completely. Like that is not what we want happening. We want you to have, you know, healthy nutrition. We want to have lots of fruits and veggies and protein and all of, you know, those health promoting foods. We don't want you to stop eating and because you're so nauseous. And if you're having those side effects, definitely reach out to whoever's prescribing your medication and talk to them. You know, do we need to go back on the dose? Do we need to change up injection sites? I will tell you anecdotally, my patients, when they switch their injection site from their abdomen to like their arm, it somehow sometimes helps with their nausea. I can't explain it. I don't know why. This is just something anecdotally that I've seen. Do we need, to make other changes? You know, what's your diet look like? Are you eating a lot of high fat foods that are exacerbating the nausea? Like, so there's things again that need to be discussed, and but it's not, you're just too nauseous to eat, and that's why the weight is coming off. Like, that's a horrible way to lose weight, right? You're just too nauseated to eat. Like, so yeah, that's a common side effect. And the constipation as well is a pretty common side effect. Not everyone experiences it, but if you do, it does tend to get better, or not better, it tends to get worse, excuse me, with escalation of dose. So as you go up on higher doses, I will tell you the nausea, if patients are having it, tends to get better over time. But again, lots of due diligence in dosing and dose escalation. Constipation, unfortunately, gets worse. And so that's something that, we have to talk to our patients about, especially if they're on other medications that can constipate them. It could really add up. Vomiting, can happen. I don't want my patients to vomit. I always tell my patients, if you're vomiting, like, something's wrong, you need to let me know immediately. Diarrhea, not so much. I don't commonly see that in my patient population. Those are kind of like, yeah, the major side effects. Now, you kind of have seen, on maybe in the media that all these medications cause stomach paralysis and gastroparesis. And, again, that's why these medications have to be prescribed with due diligence and, by somebody who's comfortable prescribing them. If somebody has baseline what's called gastroparesis, we want to make sure that, we have to understand, like, why are they having gastroparesis? Is it from diabetes? Is it from another condition? Could their, again, these medications are used for diabetes as well. Could making their diabetes better improve the gastroparesis potentially? Like, these are all discussions that have to be had. And I do think that, whenever patients do have adverse side effects and they don't have the support to work through those side effects or talk to their doctor, it's so detrimental, because it could put their health at risk. And unfortunately, some of that is happening, and it's really scary to see. I won't even get into compounded versions of the medication either, because that's a whole other slew and conversation. Yeah.
Quick note on that.
Yeah.
Don't use compounded.
Yeah. Don't use compounded versions.
Don't go to a compounded pharmacy. Don't buy off, not FDA approved versions of the medication.
Yeah.
You've already heard how, how careful you have to be with actually taking the FDA approved medication. So there's a lot to go into taking a medication. And as Dr. Patel has mentioned earlier on, like, this is a tool in the toolbox. And I know you mentioned this. Unfortunately, I don't feel like it's emphasized in most cases or in the majority of cases when people are prescribed these medications. I don't think they get the proper, counseling on lifestyle and exercise and nutrition.
No, they get it from like a med spa that like just kind of handed them a prescription, or they got it from a compounded version. I've had patients come to me and they're like, oh, I went to this med spa and I got a compounded version, and can you tell me, how to dose it? And I'm like, I have absolutely no idea what you're taking. Like, I cannot vouch for the safety of it. I can't vouch if it's going to work. Like, there was a report recently published. I think there's like an article that Eli Lilly, which is the pharmaceutical company that makes Zepbound, and Mounjaro, they found some contamination in some of the compounded versions of tirzepatide, which is a generic of that medication. Generic. I'm using generic in quotations because there is no generic for the medication, but this is what you're going to get if you go to a compounded pharmacy. They actually found contamination, and that's really scary, right? Because you're injecting it into your body, and it's
and it's just we just have to be careful with these things. And people who listen to the show know, like, I talk about this with supplements, and it's not worth risking our health in some of these cases for things that may not have the benefits. It's not going to be a magic pill. Yes, it can help you lose weight. It can help reduce some of the things we talked about, the appetite, the food noise, and can assist with eating less and help with weight loss. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to take it forever. You want to take a compounded pharmaceutical that you may not be able to get access to when that pharmacy shuts down, and you don't know what is in there, and you don't want to do that. And so if you're going to do it, make sure that you get it through a doctor who's going to do their due diligence, who's going to ask you about potential, contraindications, reasons why you shouldn't be taking it, who's going to counsel you on lifestyle, who's going to talk to you about your nutrition, who's going to talk to you about high fat meals, like you've discussed, because it's a tool in the toolbox, and you can't rely on it as the only tool, because I think there's probably going to be some negative long-term effects for a lot of people who are trying to do that. And I don't know kind of your opinion on this. I kind of like to hear it. You know, I know we're kind of coming up on time, but just a few
minutes,
like, because personally, like that story I mentioned a second ago, I saw the same thing with like bariatric surgery when it got very popular, 15 years ago when I first was into this field and seeing that. And it's like, you know, people lose all this weight short term, reduce diabetes risk, improve all their health out markers. And then 5 years later, they start to gain some of that weight back. 10 years later, they've gained a significant amount of that weight back, but they're, you know, they're also experiencing nutritional deficiencies, because anecdotally, I've met a lot of people who, you know, 10 years post, you know, bariatric surgery, they didn't change their diet. They just ate a lot less. And so they were nutrient deficient for years, and their hair is falling out, and they have thyroid issues and other health problems due to just nutritional inadequacy is what I would call it over a long period of time. So what is your thoughts there, like concerns about, you know, people kind of not following a healthy diet, not living a healthy lifestyle, taking these medications, eating less, and then what, you know, the long-term potential ramifications for that will be? Because yes, there's going to be benefits, especially in the short term in terms of weight loss and improvement in metabolic health and diabetes, blood sugar, all of that. But if people end up gaining weight, if they can't stay on the medication due to cost or insurance coverage or whatever the case may be, like there could be other, you know, things that pop up later on. Can you speak on that a bit?
Yeah. So, you know, absolutely. I guess I should say back up and say the GLP-1 receptor class of medications that we've been using for almost 2 decades, especially to start off by treating diabetes. The first one was approved in 2005. So we do have, you know, longer term data on just this class of medications. Now, of course, we most recently started using the once a week injectable medications for weight management. Like I said, Saxenda, we've been using for over a decade. But yes, there are definitely, one of the things you mentioned, if you can't get the medication due to cost long term, then yes, there is a risk of regaining the weight back. But that's also why it's important to, and there's not that many of us out there, which sucks, you know, working with somebody who is board certified in obesity medicine, because there's other options we could use. There's other things that we can do to help you maintain that weight loss, including lifestyle factors. Let me just like put that back in there, especially exercise. So yes, patients need to understand, like, look, that's the risk. If you can't take the medication, you do risk regaining weight. We also don't want you to just stop eating. I tell patients all the time, like, I don't want you to stop eating. This is not, you know, some patients have a really profound appetite suppressant. And I'm like, look, you may not feel very hungry right now, but I need you to make sure that, like, you're setting timers to remind yourself to drink water and also eat and not go all day without eating. Because I'll tell you this, like, what invariably happens is that they may end up eating more later into the evening and just end up consuming more calories because they didn't eat enough during the day. So we're trying to eat regularly, making sure we're having lean protein, making sure that we're still getting all of those health promoting foods, because we don't want you to, again, lose weight and then like also have deficiencies in certain nutrients because you had a very limited diet or you didn't eat enough protein. I don't want you to lose too much muscle. And kind of going back to what you were saying about bariatric surgery, like the paradigm is really shifting. You know, previously with bariatric surgery, patients would have surgery, they'd follow with their surgeon for a little while, and then they would get kind of turned to their own devices after that. But especially what we're doing is integrating that care. Like I've been following patients pre and post bariatric surgery. We're still making sure that they're, you know, getting the nutrients appropriately. We're checking their nutritional labs, you know, at the times that you're supposed to have at least, you know, especially if you're like 5-10 years out, yearly nutritional labs to make sure that you're not, you know, iron deficient or vitamin D deficient, which is the most, like one of the most common, you know, vitamin deficiencies out there. But that's not happening. I have patients come to me and they're like, yeah, I got bariatric surgery 15 years ago, but I'm like, do you follow with your surgeon still? And like the majority of patients say no. And then I'm checking their labs, you know, making sure that they don't have iron deficiency and whatnot, even other nutrient deficiencies as well. So yeah, I mean, this is not, it's not just here's your medication, here's your surgery, see you later. These conversations, this care is longitudinal. You know, I tell patients your health didn't deteriorate overnight, and your health's not going to improve overnight either. So it's not a quick fix. And Rome wasn't built in a day. That's what I always tell patients. If any of my patients are listening, you know, you've heard me say that Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither is your health. So it is that longitudinal follow-up. It's that due diligence. It's making sure that, like, if patients are struggling, I'm like, hey, when did you last meet with a dietitian that I work with? She's really wonderful. Hey, you know, let's do a little bit of logging to see what's going on. Like, it's trial and error, and making sure that we're thinking of all of the potential, you know, benefits and also risk, and making sure that the benefits always, always outweigh the risk when we're talking about treatment, when we're talking about certain approaches to lifestyle. And we have to pivot. Like, life is not linear. Like, stress will happen, things will happen, bad things happen to good people, and it makes it harder to follow healthy lifestyles when that happen. And I always tell my patients, reach out. If crap is hitting the fan, like, I want to know, like, if there's a death in the family and you're really struggling, like, you know, let's talk and see what we can do and help you. It's just, these are all tools, and we can't really view them as silos. It's not either or. I think that's a really big rhetoric that you hear. It's like, no, you got a lifestyle harder, or it's just meds. But it's like, no, it's the combination of these things that matter.
Whatever's going to help.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I always say at the end of the day, people ask me about things. I'm like, if it's going to help, it doesn't matter. I don't care if it's, you know, even if it's placebo, if it's going and getting acupuncture and that makes you feel better, even though
it's great.
You know, in certain circumstances, it may not be an evidence-based approach. Like, that's fine. You know, whatever is going to help you, as long as it's not people praying on you.
As long as it's within reason. Yeah, I mean, I am
convincing you of things and praying on you,
consistently charging you thousands of dollars. But if you feel better after, you know, doing certain meditative practices, like, great. As long as it's not harming you, like, and you're okay, like, fine, go for it.
Yep. And that end part of your discussion of, I know people are listening and they're like, I wish I had a doctor like this.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know that's not the norm. And unfortunately, it's not. But there are improvements being made in healthcare throughout the system to where this is becoming more common. And there are new models being put into place. And this is something that I get really excited about. And I'll bring one of my other physician friends on the podcast. We'll probably talk about this a little bit, because there's, like, new models that are kind of popping up that are allowing more integrated models of care, as you mentioned, which, in my opinion, that's really the solution. Like, nothing, these medications, they're going to work. They're going to be great. They're probably going to fall off for some people who aren't going to be able to take them long-term, who aren't going to do the right lifestyle things. And at the end of the day, it's really just, you know, our healthcare system isn't really set up, as we were talking about earlier, to provide that care and support around nutrition and lifestyle. And that's really where we need to get to, is really figuring out how to interject that model. And it's probably not going to be through insurance companies, unfortunately.
No, unfortunately not. I mean, I just don't think that, you know, insurance companies, they want to see hard data, right? They need to see, like, improvement in some health outcome. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of energy and effort and money to, you know, really run those trials, right? And I feel like it's just work that people may not want to do, or insurance companies may not want to do. And it's really unfortunate to see that. But, you know, understanding that the healthcare system is not going to be able to do everything, and healthcare systems should be open to partnering with individuals or companies that are, you know, augmenting the care that they're already giving. So making it better, right? It's not meant to disrupt or replace everything, right? Everyone always comes in, they're like, we're going to disrupt healthcare. But I'm like, good luck. Like, it's just, you know, it's a really big challenge. But if we can augment the care, like, for instance, I give the example of, I had gestational diabetes, no surprise, when I was pregnant. And there's not a lot of, it's like, of course, I had a wonderful team of doctors and people taking care of me, but it's just really hard, you know, when you're going through all that pregnancy symptoms and challenges, to take care of yourself from a gestational diabetes standpoint. And wouldn't it be great if there was some ancillary support services to kind of help with that? And really, I use the word holistically, it gets used, like, a lot in a really bad way in a lot of ways, but, you know, just really helping individuals from with 360 view of, like, supporting them emotionally, supporting them physically, making sure that, you know, there's ongoing troubleshooting of, like, okay, this is what this person can eat based on these pregnancy symptoms that they're having and limitations they're having. I'll give you my example. I had horrible acid reflux. I think a lot of pregnant women do. And then you're expected to adhere to a certain dietary pattern when you can barely eat. Like, it's just really challenging. And so it would be great, you know, to find those partners and individuals to really help augment the care that we're giving. I mean, it's desperately needed. And if you are looking for an evidence-based obesity medicine doctor, there's a search tool on the Obesity Action Coalition to kind of look to see who's board certified. Now, I will say it's not a perfect tool, but it is a tool to get the conversation started and try to find out who is in your neighborhood or city that's practicing obesity medicine. You know, we're always trying to connect patients all over the, you know, patients are moving to another state. We're on these Facebook forums and we're like, hey, does anybody have room in their practice to take on this patient? But it's so far from perfect. Like, it's not a good solution long term.
Unfortunately, there isn't any great solutions, and that's why we have to do things like this podcast, to really help people to make their best informed decisions on their own and find the care that's going to be most appropriate for them. And in my opinion, in most cases, that's really good conventional medical care, and then a nutritionist who is really good. Like,
A
I don't
really
think
good
there's
one.
anything more valuable for long-term health than having, you know, someone who can help you with nutrition, and then also has, you know, a bit of an understanding on the other lifestyle things, like we talked about
Physical
earlier, the
activity,
exercise and stuff matters,
stress.
sleep and all that matters, but nutrition is just the most difficult to just dial
Absolutely.
in, get appropriate for you. It just takes a little bit more technical knowledge for that. But I really appreciate this discussion. We've been going on for quite some time, and I think we covered, you know, everything in terms of how the medications work, what they are, the probably some medications that people didn't expect to hear anything about today, side effects. And also, I think really refreshing to hear, you know, you talk about this integrated model of care. I think that everyone, myself included, and all the physicians that I network with and bring on this podcast, all the physicians that I network with and bring on this podcast all have that same vision and hope for the future of some integrated model of care where we're all working together and really helping the patients get the best available care and do what's really best for them. And hopefully we can help create something like that in the future.
Absolutely.
I
I
love
can't wait to see
connecting.
what you're up to, Dr. Chavez.
Definitely, definitely. So I appreciate this discussion. Thank you for coming on. And can
Absolutely.
you
Thanks
tell
so much.
everyone where they can follow you and get more information about where you practice and kind of just keep up with what you have going on?
So I am on Twitter and Instagram at Dr. Plantel. So I'm Dr. Patel. I love, you know, eating plants. There's a lot of reasons to do that, no matter what dietary pattern you're following. So it's a little play on my name. So yeah, feel free to reach out and any follow-up questions, happy to answer. But it was so great to have this discussion. And thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, thank you so much. I will link that in the show notes, and I appreciate you for coming on.
Awesome. Thanks.